This is an RNZ podcast.
Susan Burdett came up again, and it was pointed out to Tainer that there was a reward. And he said he knew something. And I guess that moment, his life changed forever.
Hi, I'm Jesse Mulligan, host of the Daily Afternoons program on RNZ. You're listening to Crimes NZ, a series where I talk with people who are connected in some way or other with serious crimes that have happened here in New Zealand. In this episode, we're covering the wrongful murder conviction of Tainer Porter with journalist Eugene Bingham, who's covered the story for many years.
I must give credit to New Zealand Herald, former colleague of mine, Phil Taylor. He wrote a story in 2012 quoting a former detective, or detective at the time, Dave Henwood, who was expressing serious doubts about the conviction of Tainer. I'd been a police reporter at the Herald, used to work with Phil, and knew how if Dave Henwood thinks this is unsafe, then there must be something really odd about it. So that was the beginning, really.
Can you give us a bit of your background, how you became an investigative journalist, and what makes that different to a sort of a day-to-day journalist?
Yeah, it's a good question, because in a way, all journalists should be investigative journalists, shouldn't they, really? I started at the Herald in the early 90s, 1991, worked in various rounds, but eventually, and went down to the gallery, for instance, spent time overseas, but eventually sort of just found myself working my way towards the harder stories that take a bit longer. And I've been lucky to have a series of jobs where I do get the time to dig into things and spend a bit of time investigating. And the Tainer Porter case is probably the one that took us the longest time and was the hardest one to crack.
We should mention where you're working now, because you've got a great role there.
Yeah, absolutely. So I worked at TV3, started working at TV3 on the story with Paula Penfold. And then in 2015, we left TV3 and we started at Stuff soon after that. And I've got a great role there where I continue to have time to dig into stories.
And do you have a few stories on the go at all time? Because some of them don't follow the sort of the linear narrative, right? It's not like get up and work this one out today.
Yeah, absolutely.
Write it up tomorrow, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. It's some of them can literally take years. We produced a story last year about the firing ranges in Afghanistan, and that took a number of years to be able to, from the moment that we first sort of heard about it and I started looking at it, till the time that it was actually out in the public was years.
What's the moment like, by the way, when you finally get to publish?
Terrifying sometimes. it's good. It's good. I mean, it's our job is to tell stories. And so, of course, once a story is out there, then it's a good moment. But, yeah, sometimes it's...
Why terrifying?
You put it all out there. Well, sometimes there are big implications for stories. And you don't rush into things lightly. You take people's, people's lives seriously. Sometimes there are big implications for people. And I don't take that lightly. So, yeah, there's a little moment of a bit of nervousness when a story does finally make it to air or in print.
What's the job of an investigative journalist?
To listen, to be curious, to spend time figuring things out, to understand what's gone wrong. I'm particularly drawn to stories about injustice, and so that requires sometimes listening to people who haven't been listened to and seeing where things have gone wrong and trying to untangle it. And sometimes that takes a long time.
Is it about power?
Yeah, sometimes it is. Sometimes it is. The powerful haven't listened to people. And Tainer is a classic case where the people in power didn't listen to him. He was saying, from not very long after he was arrested, "I didn't do this." And no one listened until Tim McKinnell came along in 2009. So, yeah, absolutely, it's about power.
In fact, when you think of the powerless in society, Tainer Porter, it's a pretty classic example, right?
It's extremely sad. He was and is extremely vulnerable. and to see what happened to him is an indictment on us all, I think.
Can you tell us a bit about him?
Yeah, sure.
Maybe in the years leading up to the crime.
Yeah, sure. So he grew up in South Auckland. He was his mother died when he was four. His father wasn't really on the scene. So him and his brothers and sisters ended up moving around family members. He didn't find school very easy. He was a very, very talented sports person. And, some people say if but for, he would have been, representative rugby or league player.
Wow.
Very talented musician. An extremely prolific car thief. Once held a record for the number of cars he stole in one night in South Auckland. So he got into trouble quite early. But from all accounts, it was sort of car crime, that sort of thing. And so I had lots of brushes with the law. He had a child by the time he was 16, Chanel, and he was living with an aunt on and off who had sort of taken on the role of mother for him at the time that this all began.
So what happened the night of the murder of Susan Burdett?
Yeah, so Susan was an accounts clerk. She had a great circle of friends. She loved playing ten-pin bowling and was apparently a very talented ten-pin bowler, had won lots of awards, prizes. She was out at Superstrike, which ten-pin bowling place in Monaco, came home. She lived alone, she'd say, and she came home to her flat in Papatoetoe, had a shower and was brutally attacked and raped. She didn't turn up for work the next day. Eventually, a friend came around and found her dead in her bed.
And tell me about the investigation by police.
Well, it was, obviously it was a big case. This was a terrible crime. And so there was a lot of investigative power put into it. The police were desperate to find who'd done this. But after a year, they didn't have anyone. A reward was put up, $20,000 reward for information. But still after a year, they had no one until Tainer walked in the door.
Okay. Mm. Under what circumstances did he walk in the door?
Yeah, it's a little bit complicated. In fact, we need to sort of back up the truck a little bit with Tainer's involvement. So the aunt that I mentioned who had taken him under, who was looking after him, she had actually reported him to the police as a suspect early on when he told her about a softball bat. Or she heard about a softball bat that he and some friends had found at the Monaco Velodrome. And it was in the media that a baseball bat or a softball bat had been used to bludgeon Susan. And she told the police. And Tainer was actually brought in for questioning twice. The aunt became convinced that Tainer was involved and kept on ringing the police and saying, he's done it. There was a police, obviously he was questioned twice. He denied involvement. He happily gave a DNA sample. His DNA sample didn't match the DNA sample at the scene. And eventually the aunt's evidence was dismissed by a very senior officer as irrelevant, that she was a conspiracy theorist, in fact, and was put aside. But then just about a few days short of a year of after the crime, Tainer was brought in for questioning. Well, he was arrested on a warrant, actually, for those car crimes, or some car crimes. Mm. He was brought in. Somehow the topic of Susan Burdett came up again, and it was pointed out to Tainer that there was a reward. And he said he knew something. And I guess that moment his life changed forever.
How long did it take from them, from then, for police to arrest him on that case or to charge him?
Yeah, so what happened was over the next 4 days, he was questioned about the Burdett case. And they became known, and they were videotaped. Well, some of them were videotaped. Some of those interviews were videotaped. They became known as the confessions of Tainer. I don't really like calling them confessions because when you look at them, he's not really confessing. His story changes. He gets things horribly wrong. He can't describe Susan accurately. He can't describe the bed where this crime happened accurately. He doesn't know that it's, he just gets things so much wrong, when the police take him to the scene, they say they want to take him to the scene where it happened, he gets lost on the way. He can't point out her house. It's supposedly a house where this, you think you'd remember.
Yeah.
He can't identify it. Eventually the police point it out and he says, this is the house we came to, which the sort of, it's sort of a, quite a chilling, when you watch the videos and you hear him say that, you just want to stop, pause it and say, no, don't say that.
Mm.
It's, you don't know what you're saying. So after those 4 days of police interviews, the police believed they had enough evidence to charge him, and he was charged on the anniversary of Susan Burdett's murder.
And he went to court?
Went to court, 17 years old, and in June the following year was convicted and sentenced to life imprisonment, sent to Pariamarumo prison, where he spent most of the next 21 years with some of the most hardened criminals in the country.
When you look at the evidence that the jury saw, are you surprised that they convicted him?
It's really hard to put yourself in their shoes at the time. Of course, you know, when I look at what I know now, I think, how could this have happened? But, you know, I guess that's the thing. No one ever really knows what goes on in a jury room.
Mm.
Here was this young kid who, you know, had a criminal history. He gave evidence himself. He was quite, he didn't come across well when he gave evidence, when he was cross-examined. It didn't go well for Tainer. And so I guess the jury just didn't look very favourably at what he was saying. He couldn't explain, although at that point he was saying, I was lying. I wasn't involved in this case. The jury didn't believe him and he was convicted.
Have you ever heard from a jury member in the course of your investigation?
Not from that case, but from a later trial. So there was another trial. I don't know how much further you want me to get ahead, but there was a later trial, and we did hear from a juror in that who said, I've got it wrong. It was in the Malcolm Rayway case.
Okay.
So we've never heard of a Tainer Pora juror, but we have heard of, the man who was eventually convicted of the murder of Susan Burdett. We've heard of one of his jurors.
I'm talking to Eugene Bingham, by the way, who was one of the investigative journalists who worked on the Tainer Pora case, as it's sort of become known. It's the rape and murder of Susan Burdett. But Tainer Pora's name has wrongfully really been associated with that crime. And Eugene also mentioned Malcolm Brewer, who we will get to. So why was there another trial? Is that the next part in the story, the second trial?
Yeah, so 1994, Tainer's in prison. The police case was that there was someone else involved, because there had to be for the police case to be right, because it wasn't Tainer's DNA that was found at the crime scene. So there must have been someone else. And what happened is that eventually there was another investigation going on in South Auckland into a series of unsolved rapes. And eventually there was a connection made between the Burdett homicide and these other rapes. They knew that it was the same person, the DNA sample matched. And eventually, in 1996, they identified that person as Malcolm Rewa. He was arrested and he was tried he was eventually convicted of the rape of Susan Burdett and 24 other women. All brutal attacks, all those other attacks carried out alone in a very strikingly similar way, in ways that matched the crime scene at Susan Burdett's place. So he was convicted in 1998 of the rape of Susan Burdett, but the jury couldn't decide on whether he was guilty of murder. He was tried a second time on the rape and murder of Susan Burdett, and was eventually convicted of the rape, but they couldn't decide on the murder charge a second time. So a stay of execution was put in place by the Crown, which means they wouldn't take another trial. After Malcolm Rewa was convicted of the rape of Susan Burdett, he appealed and was granted another trial. So there was another trial in 2000. The police at that point really had a decision to make. Do we go after Tainer?
or after Tainer?
Yeah, do we go after Tainer again, or do we look at it and go, well, Malcolm Lewa really, in every other case, acted alone. Why would he suddenly take a 17-year-old or a 16-year-old along with him to a crime scene? It just didn't make sense. Mm.
Tainer's still in jail, by the way.
Tainer was awaiting a retrial. So the police found witnesses who were prepared to say that Malcolm Rewa and Tainer Porter knew each other. There's a lot of problems with that evidence, including people being paid, including one of them being a jailhouse snitch. But nonetheless, it went to trial in 2000, and once again, Tainer was found guilty. So he went back inside. And here he was, feeling, I guess, I can't imagine what he felt, you know, just abandoned by the system, that he finally had hope in, that something would happen, that he'd finally get out, turned on by his family. His aunt had been one of the people who'd given evidence against him. She'd been paid to give evidence against him. Other cousins spoke out against him.
How has he been paid?
Yeah, well, it's a very good question. Police witnesses, in that case, three of them were paid to give evidence. Or paid for their, you know, they were paid, paid to give evidence. So three of them received together $15,000. Tainer must have just felt shattered to be back inside in 2000 again, once again, staring down the barrel of a very, very long time in prison for a crime that he knew he didn't do.
You point out, by the way, that a friendship or an association between these two men seemed pretty unlikely on the surface.
Yeah, very, very unlikely. There was a big age difference. Also, Malcolm Rewa, he acted alone in every other of the rapes that he was convicted of. He was also associated with the Highway 61 gang. He was sergeant at arms, a bit of an enforcer, got the nickname Hammer for the Highway 61 gang. Tainer was, I'd describe it as sort of running around with the mongrel mob at the time of the murder. He wasn't a member. He wasn't officially an associate. In fact, he was in trouble with them a bit. But the concept of the mongrel mob and somebody from the mongrel mob or hanging around the mongrel mob associating with somebody from the Highway 61 was just so improbable. And yet the police pushed ahead with that theory.
So is the next part in the story when you get a sniff of things?
Well, no, the next important part is 2009 when Tim McKinnell becomes involved. He was a private investigator by that stage. He'd been a young police officer in South Auckland at the time that Tainer was convicted. And he heard stories. He says that if you wanted to start a row in the police bar, you just bring up the name Tainer Porter and cops would be arguing about it, and there were many who believed that he wasn't guilty. Tim always struck Tim as unusual. So when he studied he did his master's of criminology. He had a look at Tainer's case and eventually went to see Tainer and got his agreement to start looking at the case. If it hadn't been for Tim McKinnell, I really do wonder if Tainer would still be in prison. I really think he's an incredible person who doesn't get the recognition that he deserves for what he did for Tainer.
Was someone paying him to do that, or was it just
no,
a project?
It was all off his own bat. Yeah. He did hundreds and I can't even estimate how many hours of free work, time away from his young family, time away from his business, just because he really believed that Tainer was innocent and that it was up to him to do something. He brought on board Jonathan Krebs and Ingrid Squire, two lawyers in the Hawke's Bay, where he was based at the time. And together they formed a pretty incredible team, which eventually, saw Tainer freed.
So can you talk us through what happens next and sort of your involvement as well?
Yeah, so skip to 2012. This Dave Henwood comes out in the Herald, and Phil Taylor's story says, I believe that Tainer is innocent, an innocent man's in jail. That made Paula and I go, we both knew of Dave Henwood. Knew that he wouldn't say things very lightly. So we started looking at it. And I remember the moment we went and saw Tim we did a story for 60 Minutes, which was just reporting on the fact that, I wouldn't call it an investigation at that point, it was just a story that, this person or people were having a look at Tainer Porter's conviction. But we went down and saw Tim And I remember he sat us down in his office garage and showed us the tapes, showed us the videotapes. And when you watched them, you couldn't help but feel enraged that he was this young guy who clearly had no idea what had gone on, but he was still in jail, still languishing in jail, convicted of this murder and rape that he didn't commit. So we, Paula and I, decided at that point to sort of do something we'd never done before in our journalistic careers, and that was, you know, we were going to put our stake in the ground and say Tony Paula is innocent. And we called our next story An Innocent Man, which was a big step for us. And we just spent the next few years really campaigning and digging up evidence. And the more we found, the more and more it was obvious that, you know, what had gone on. And Phil Taylor kept investigating. Michael Bennett, a filmmaker, worked on the case as well with his wife Jane. And eventually, you know, it took a long time for the public to kind of get behind Tana, but eventually they did.
How does that manifest?
And how does what manifest? Sorry?
The public getting behind something.
Yeah, well, eventually there were free Tana T-shirts. Mm-hmm. There was a hip hop song, and people there were calls for inquiries. The police association even came out and called for an inquiry.
Wow.
Yeah, which doesn't happen lightly. You know, MPs were calling for an inquiry, and yet the police remained steadfast.
And do I have it right that Tana had actually been released on parole by then? Or was around that time?
It was around that time. So it was 2014. Yeah, it was after a couple of years after the public campaign began. So he eventually got parole, even though he was still convicted. There was a few bumps in the road there with his being released on parole, but eventually he was in 2014. And then his case eventually went to the Privy Council. Jonathan Krebs led the team that went to the Privy Council and appealed his case, and they heard his case. A really important step that should be mentioned is that when his videos were being played on television at one point, a specialist in fetal alcohol syndrome disorder, FASD, Valerie McGinn, she saw the videotapes and she immediately recognised there's something wrong with this guy. There's an issue here. And so she got hold of Tim McKinnell. Eventually she carried out some tests on Tana and she diagnosed him with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, as being on the fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. So, which of course threw a huge new focus on the case. He'd been the mental age of an 8 to 10 year old, Valerie assessed, at the time of the murders, which explains his behaviour in the videos. Explains the way that he acted. Part of his condition is he wants to please people, and you see it when you interact with him, but you see it in the videotapes. He wants the police to be happy with him. He wants them to agree with, you know, he doesn't want to upset them. So that was crucial, and it gave a breakthrough. And in fact, it was the breakthrough which led to the Privy Council deciding that there had been a miscarriage of justice and quashing his convictions.
I have to ask you, I keep thinking of the same scene, and I only mention it because it's a scene that a lot of people might have seen. It's in the Netflix series Making a Murderer, where they're talking to, I think it's Brendan Dassey, the young boy, and the police are really putting the pressure on and end up seemingly getting him to admit to a crime that he didn't do just so that he could get out of that room and didn't really grasp the gravity. I don't know if you've seen that scene and whether it reminded you of the...
Yeah, it's complicated in that I don't think that the police set out to set up Tana. I really don't. I don't think they... But I just think there wasn't the right amount of care shown, and the alarm bells weren't listened to. The alarm bells that when he was getting so much wrong, somebody should have been saying, well, in fact, people were saying, hang on a minute, but they weren't listened to. There should have been more caution around him. Of course, they didn't know that he had FASD, but there were moments in the videotape when you look at it, he can't spell very simple words. He's asked what a meter is. He doesn't know. He's unsure of his left from right, things like that. It should have just made the police go, hang on, we just need to proceed a bit more carefully. They weren't. That didn't happen.
Want to make sure we get the whole story. We've got about 3 minutes left. So he has conviction was quashed by the Privy Council in London. Can you remember that moment when
you
got that news?
Absolutely. We were at Michael Bennett, the filmmaker I mentioned. It was a gathering at his house. Taine was there as well. And, that's the moment it was announced and everyone was pretty happy. Pretty happy. Taine was a bit overwhelmed, to be honest. He was quite quiet. I don't think he took it in very well.
What's your view on the impact that 20 years in prison's had on him?
Yeah, it's hard to describe. He was a guy who was, you know, he was vulnerable to start with because of his condition. He, you know, he didn't have much schooling. He was already, you know, in and out of trouble with the law. And then we throw him in prison for more than 20 years with some of the most hardened criminals in the country. And when he was eventually released, he was just, you know, put out into society. When the convictions were quashed, he had no proper help from the system. It's tough. It's really hard being Taine Apoorah.
How's he doing now?
It's really hard being Taine Apoorah. Yeah. He remains vulnerable. He remains the person who was messed up for a long, long time. You know, when we eventually met him, and I remember saying to him, how do you do it? How do you keep sane? How do you not keep angry? And he by that stage was very sort of zen-like almost. He said, yeah, I can see how you would think that, but for me, I just take each day as it comes. But he admits that for the first 10 years that he was in prison, he was very angry. He was in fights all the time and furious. And he's quite a small guy, so he got beaten up a lot. He didn't have an easy time in prison, that's for sure. Times were tough, and that leaves scars, and he carries those scars today.
You're just a journalist who covered the story, and so probably you don't owe him anything, but it seems to me that you've been quite moved by the experience.
Absolutely. You can't help but be involved in his story, but you know, without being moved. It's incredibly sad what happened to him. It's so unjust. It makes you sad, but it also makes you angry that it happened. It also, you know, as much as it makes you mad, you also see the good in people. People like Tim McKinnell, people like Jonathan Krebs and Ingrid Squire, and you know, people who help him now, Fiki Taito and others who go out of their way to help him in spite of a lot of challenges, in spite of a lot of, you know, obstacles. And so I guess that, you know, those sorts of things do give you hope as well.
This has been Crimes NZ with me, Jesse Mulligan. You can find more episodes of the series on the RNZ podcast page or on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your favourite podcasts. If you like this series, try Black Sheep. It's another award-winning RNZ podcast series. And along with other great podcasts, you can find it on our RNZ podcast page.